personal hardship. But when I started to work in the welfare department in the spring of 1940, I saw what really existed. And just to give people a flavor of what it was like when, in those days, sure, there was, if you were absolutely without means, you had no job, you had no resources, and you had no legally responsible relatives, meaning you didn't have parents or grandparents or adult children, then and only then were you eligible for some kind of welfare assistance. And I worked out in East New York, Brooklyn, and I remember the first time I saw an eviction. And evictions still occurred, welfare or not, because you applied for welfare and then it might take 5-6 weeks before, even when you were accepted, before you got the first rent check and mm-hmm. so on. And so people were being evicted all the time. First one I saw occurred in a rain. I was making the rounds visiting the welfare clients on my list, and I saw a crowd around, men came out of this small apartment house carrying terrible sticks of furniture, you know, not worth anything, and putting the family's belongings out on the sidewalk in the rain. And the family would come out, sometimes with small children and so on. And first time I saw it, I wondered about the people watching, and because they were silent, just absolutely silent. They said nothing to each other, nothing to the family moving out. And the sheriff and his deputies would deposit everything out on the sidewalk, and then they would disappear. They would go around the corner somewhere. Good. And then everybody
we ready?
Yeah, rolling.
All right.
After the sheriff and his deputy had moved all their possessions on the sidewalk and then disappeared, I saw the first time the most remarkable sight. All of these neighbors and people who had been standing so silently, without a word, began to pick up everything there was and put it back into the house.
That's right.
And I would ask somebody, what are they doing?
Yeah.
He said, I do this all the time. This is it's like a ritual. He said, the sheriff knows it happens, but he's done his duty. He's put it all out on the street, disappeared. The neighbors know their role, and back it goes. And you know, you asked before, how do you learn these things? You learn what solidarity in times of crisis means, and they had it. And what I've described is something that used to happen a couple of times a week on my route. At any rate, yeah, I think the whole welfare department experience was a learning one in very many ways.
So take us to your transition into working for the labor movement. How did you move from?
Yeah. Well, as the United States got involved in World War II, the federal government began creating agencies to cope with all kinds of problems, the War Production Board, the War Manpower Commission, the War Labor Board, and so on. OPA controlled prices to prevent inflation and so on. And I had taken all kinds of civil service examinations at various times when I was unemployed. And I began getting job offers. And the War Production Board enticed me to Washington. And my wife and I, we were married at the end of 1939. And period I'm talking about is close to the end of 1942, 3 years later.
And that was because you were an economics person. They were very involved in the economics of planning for the war effort, and so you brought, that would have been more your economic background than what turned out to be the labor background, am I correct?
That's true. I was hired as an economist, and at any rate, to make a long story short, I moved to the National War Labor Board the following year, and that was absolutely the most valuable experience in dealing with labor relations and labor management affairs. The War Labor Board had an unprecedented task. It had a dual task. One was to attempt to stabilize wages so that nobody could get a wage increase without an application to the board and the board approved it. But it also had a disputes division. And the purpose of the disputes division was to provide a mechanism for resolving disputes other than through strikes or lockouts. We were now in a war. War production was exceedingly important, not just for this country, but for those we were supplying. And Roosevelt had approached the brand new CIO and the older AFL, and he suggested that he would like to see a no-strike pledge for the duration. And of course, they wanted to know about industry, and I think this was a learning period for Franklin Roosevelt too. And he kind of learned that there were two sides to this coin, and he belatedly approached the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, asked for a no-strike, no-lockout pledge, no-lockout pledge from them, got it, and now we still had a problem. The labor movement, in effect, said, how are we going to resolve disputes? Here was the brand new CIO, having organized millions of industrial workers. They were still getting depression wages. Disputes were inevitable. And Roosevelt, by executive order, created the disputes division of the War Labor Board. And believe it or not, they were to handle every dispute in the United States. Mm-hmm. Every labor management dispute. Nobody had ever done this before.
Yeah. And don't we have to point out that Taft-Hartley didn't come to 47, so a lot of what people think about as the structure of labor now didn't exist in your day.
That's true. The Wagner Act did exist. That was 1935. And that was, in effect, a charter which said that collective bargaining was the accepted national policy to resolve disputes. In effect, it legalized strikes. And now you've got a war which says, can't strike.
It's
quite a dilemma. At any rate, the War Labor Board was created, and it did an absolutely marvelous job. And again, I was most fortunate to become a hearing officer there and in the disputes division, and really learn what labor management disputes were all about, because in that role you handled not just wages and salaries, but union security and seniority and shift differentials and insurance plans and everything, every issue that you can imagine would come up in these disputes.
So you got a great education, but you also met a lot of the people who became important in...
That's true. In the War Labor Board, in Washington and in the 12 regions throughout, each board consisted of public members, who were the neutrals, labor members, and industry members. And each board was tripartite in structure. And you had to, in any dispute, the the disputing parties had to win a majority of those votes to have their way. But, you know, the World Labor Board, as you might expect, ended when the war ended. And, first I was still in Washington, in Philadelphia, and then I went to Washington and I worked for the U.S. Conciliation Service. And from there, the Machinists Union, which really was the first union where I was an employee. The International Association of Machinists, known as the IAM, one of the oldest unions in the country, had gotten its start with the beginnings of the railroads in the United States. And that I really was, despite my experience with the War Labor Board, I really was still a novice. And I was assigned to do some organizing aircraft plants in Baltimore, the Glenn L. Martin plant, and out in Long Island, and so on. At various times, I moved around. I worked for the UAW, the auto workers, for a brief period. And then someone I had worked with in the World Labor Board, name was Otis Brubaker, had become the research director of the Steelworkers Union. And a vacancy occurred, and next thing I know, I was in Philip Murray's office and being interviewed by this charming labor leader who I had never met and who everybody pictured as a really fiery labor leader, only to discover that he was so shy he didn't quite know how to ask me questions. At any rate, from that interview, I began with the Steelworkers Union in the spring of 1950. And as the Associate Director of Research, and took on more and more responsibilities as time went on.
Now, were you there during the steel seizure, or was that just before you got there?
No, I was there during the steel seizure. I started in March of 1950, and the steel seizure was in 1952.
Yeah.
The Korean War had started in 51, and steelworker disputes, I think probably most people don't know, from the time the steelworkers organized the steel industry into the CIO in 1936, almost every dispute ended up in the White House. It just seemed unable to resolve disputes through collective bargaining. This was not so with regard to other contracts that the steelworkers had, and their jurisdiction extended to aluminum, copper, lead, zinc, iron ore, metal fabricating, all kinds and so on. But in the basic steel industry, it was, in a sense, in the beginning, like the baseball industry. That is, they didn't accept the idea that they were unions.
Can I just ask you again, for the historical point of view, people 50 years from now, given the fact that the steel industry here has basically shrunk, they won't have a sense of how huge the steel industry was and how important. So I think, if you don't mind, it's important to color that, because...
I think that's true. And the Steelworkers Union, what was first organized, as I say, in 1936.
But without steel, we couldn't exist in those days, whereas today we exist.
I shudder to think what would have happened in World War II without steel.
Yeah. But
the Steelworkers Union, when I left 15 years later, 16 years later, had 1.25 million members, 1,249,000 members. It had the entire basic steel industry, which consisted of about 500,000 workers at that point in time. As aluminum became more and more important, the entire aluminum industry became part of the steelworkers' jurisdiction. And it wasn't just making the basic steel, it was all of the things that you had to shape steel into. The raw material really for building a railroad, for tracks, for locomotives,
for girders, for every building,
for every all of construction, for automobiles, and later for tanks and artillery and on like this.
Right.
And
there were a huge number. I mean, not only U.S. Steel, but there were five or six enormous steel-making companies in those days.
Oh, yeah. The Big 12 were the biggest ones. All kinds of names. I think people are familiar sometimes, or were familiar, more than they are now. U.S. Steel and Bethlehem and Republic and Jones and Lockland.
Jones and Lockland,
yeah. Youngstown Sheet and Tube and on.
And they're all gone.
Great Lakes Steel Corporation.
Yeah.
Wheeling Steel here we are. It's only 2004, and we're talking about a little over half a century ago, and it has vastly changed even now. It's hard to give the coloration of how steel was viewed, but I suppose one indication I've already mentioned is that when there was a dispute in steel, when there was a nationwide strike, it wasn't just the steel companies who were affected, but in a very short period of time, all of these industries dependent on steel would begin to go down. Without a supply of steel, the automobile plants would begin to go down, railroads would curtail, aircraft production would fall off, and on like this. You wouldn't be able to get a refrigerator, you wouldn't be able to buy your house, and so on. Understandably, a steel dispute became a political matter, and the White House had to be involved, and actually was involved in every single dispute in those years.
Now take us through your career at the steelworkers. Obviously you were there, what did you say, 15 years? And sort of give a picture of how you got to baseball, but what was your career through the steelworkers?
Well, in the beginning, job as associate director of research was what it sounded like. We performed the basic research to give the facts and the tools of negotiation to the top officers and for their use in negotiation. We would write their organizing and political speeches for them. We would testify before congressional committees looking into antitrust aspects, looking into the pricing monopoly behavior of some of the steel companies and so on.
Did you deal with strategy? Did you help on the strategy of how you would attack various issues or various industries?
Yes. In the beginning, you have to understand about the steelworkers' jurisdiction. The basic steel people, who were about half the union, about 500,000 people, all of those contracts were handled from the headquarters, from centrally, no matter where the steel company was located. The other half of the Steelworkers Union worked in what was loosely called metal fabricating and other metals. And they would be administered by district directors out in the field. So that in the beginning, you were most likely to be involved with contracts out in the field, district directors without the background that came to be needed in modern negotiations, needed the help more than the top officers in basic steel. But as you gained experience in dealing with the so-called lesser contracts out in the field, we became involved with the negotiations that were handled centrally. And that would be basic steel and aluminum can manufacturing, iron ore, and so on. And at a certain point in time, I was on all of the top negotiating committees. Philip Murray, who I had met when I was hired in 1950, died at the end of 1952. And David MacDonald, who had been his secretary treasurer, became president. And sometime after that, I was promoted to assistant to the president of the union and as chief economist of the Steelworkers Union. And in that role, I was involved with all of the top level negotiations.
If I were to say to you, pick out two or three of the lessons, the sort of insights that you took from those steelworkers years and sort of take us forward, are there some things that you learned in those experiences that were directly relevant or that you employed very handsomely in baseball?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are probably more than two or three, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to articulate them. Certainly it was the steelworkers' experience that made me realize that it really didn't matter who you were, and it didn't matter that you were now working for the most prestigious of the unions and one of the largest and wealthiest, that when you got down to negotiations, what mattered is, did you have the support and the understanding of the rank and file worker? All the rest of it was really secondary or tertiary.
But that's a very important point, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And that was true whether it was necessary to mobilize for a strike or whether the negotiations were relatively peaceful and constructive. It still always came down to what kind of support and understanding and solidarity did you have with the membership you were representing.
How about the relevance of the politics? I would have thought one of the lessons would have been, and I'm interrupting you, but wouldn't one of the lessons be that negotiations are both economic and political, and that part of the process is winning over the hearts and minds of some constituency?
Well, political in the sense I've just mentioned.
Small p, yes.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And when you got down to, you know, to basic steel negotiations, it was political in the capital P sense.
Yep.
as well. Just to go into that a little deeper, I don't think I'm getting across the point about how you get solidarity and support. It isn't just that you're aware that you need it. You have to be so patient to make sure, even though you are boring yourself by saying things over and over and over again, that there are no new ways to educate a membership. It always comes down to making sure that they understand the issues, making sure that you're reflecting what they want you to do, not what you want to do, but what they, And I don't mean to leave out the leadership necessary to get them to understand what's important and what's not important. There's that too. But you can never get away from the need to have input so that you are not flying blind. I watched some district directors in the steelworkers, capable people, so on, who had grown through the years to either not understand or had forgotten what they once knew, who would assume that because they were experienced trade unionists, that they knew what was best for the people they were representing, without making sure that they had an input and that they understood what you were doing. Fatal mistake, fatal error. It's one, I don't know, maybe I've made it from time to time, but I've tried not to. Because there are times when you're sure you know better. You've been there and they haven't. Doesn't matter. They have to understand.
I have a thesis about you, but I don't want to raise it too early, but I've always said that the act of genius that you brought to baseball was to convert what may have been exclusively an economic issue into both an economic and a moral issue, and that you painted the owners in moral terms, mm-hmm. and that was an absolute act of genius. And if it's my thesis and I'm correct, the question is, did some of that come from the early beginning?
Oh, yes. And I don't know about this genius business, but clearly this was a learned skill.